and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with what could be a very eventful week, with rumours swirling that Robert Mueller may drop indictments at the end of the week, and speak with David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report, who was a special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. He joins us to discuss how Donald Trump, the weak strongman in the White House who acts as though he is increasingly under siege, is lashing out like a frightened bully. We will assess whether Trump's hatchet man Whitaker will try to stop Mueller and the setbacks for democracy and the rule of law around the world Trump is causing on the foreign policy front as he indulges dictators and murderers while dissing allies. And with the daily trampling of democratic norms and Trump's crude assault on dignity and decency, what stands out as almost inexplicable is the possibility that in spite of all the wreckage, Trump could be re-elected in 2020. With that in mind, we'll examine what possible leadership could emerge amongst the Democrats, offering a narrative for the majority in opposition that Americans can coalesce around. Then we'll look into the extent to which Trump's unconditional embrace of the murderous Saudi Crown Prince MBS will curtail or undermine efforts by Secretary of Defense Mattis and Secretary of State Pompeo to bring about an end to the disastrous war in Yemen started by MBS. Sheila Carapico, a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond and author of Arabia Incognita, Dispatches from Yemen and the Gulf, joins us to discuss the need for humanitarian intervention and a diplomatic effort to end the agony and the starvation of children, which may also allow the Saudis to get out of the quagmire they have created. Then finally, Netta Crawford, a professor of political science at Boston University, who is the lead author of a new report at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University, Cost of War, joins us. We'll discuss how the U.S. has spent $6 trillion on wars that have killed 500,000 people since 9/11, and how the high costs of war and war-related costs pose a national security concern in themselves because they are unsustainable. Furthermore, with the United States military operating in 76 countries, there are no comprehensive strategies to end the wars and deal with other pressing national security priorities. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Thank you, Ian.
And on this Monday after Thanksgiving weekend, it would seem to me that there's a window opening here in Washington up to Christmas where there's an expectation there's going to be a lot of activity. I'm told that Mueller is going to hand down a bunch of indictments at the end of the week. What's your sense of what to look for this week?
Well, I hope you're right. The president is a crook across so many dimensions. Mueller is looking into some of those. Other people are looking into others. I don't know what's coming, but it seems to me in a time when the president has behaved like a little baby, whining and crying and lying all the time, Mueller's investigation has moved straight ahead, hasn't paid attention to politics, focused on the facts, said no comment to media. And hopefully they will have the strength to realize that a responsible criminal investigation is one that really pushes and probes and makes sure that everyone who is responsible for these offenses is brought to justice.
So do you think that we can, I mean, what do you make of Trump's behavior of late? He's always been mercurial, ludicrously amateurish, embarrassingly inarticulate and unqualified. But I think at his heart, he's a weak strongman, and I get the feeling he's running out of places to hide. I mean, he's sort of like a frightened bully. And I think his greatest fear is that he's going to be unmasked as a crook, as you say, but maybe even as a traitor. That's my sense, that he's really, in a way, I don't think he wanted this job. I think he wanted the fame and feed his narcissism. But more than that, he wanted to improve the brand of Trump and make a ton of money and then run around the country attacking Hillary Clinton, leading rallies, lock her up, lock her up, lock her up, etc. I think that was the plan. And he got blindsided by the fact that he got elected. And for the first time in his life, he's under real scrutiny. He's always been one step ahead of the sheriff in terms of his business activities and his financial money laundering with the Russians, etc. But that's my take on him. What's your take on him?
I think you pretty much got it right. He does seem cornered. I mean, the only way I would quibble with your description is I think he did want the job, in the sense he wanted to be president, and he kind of thought he could keep on doing what he's doing, which is not work very hard, get the fame, get the attention, get the luxury, as he says when he gives people a tour of the White House, have you ever seen such luxury? But so he wanted the job, but he wants it on his terms, which is to say he's too busy. Oh, I'm too busy to visit the troops. I did a whole bunch of calls, when he's really not busy. And there was a very interesting quote in the Washington Post, I think, on Friday before last, where a former White House official said he's scared to go visit the troops. He's scared of that environment. He was scared during the debate with Hillary Clinton. He was visibly kind of, you know, making these weird sounds. He is a scared man, but he's succeeding. And frankly, as much as we can gloat that we're enjoying watching him shake and be nervous and feel cornered, he's getting what he wants. He's got a million reporters asking questions. He talked about how he's surely Trump is going to be on Time's Man of the Year. And he may be reelected. No one thought he'd be. The same people who are saying he couldn't be elected are now saying he can't be reelected. There are a whole lot of people who enjoy his brand of entertainment and demagoguery and white supremacy, and it's going to take really hard work to get rid of him.
Well, I think the biggest issue, though, is that the real challenge in the world today is whether democratic regimes that operate on the rule of law will survive against a tide of authoritarian, kleptocratic criminality that seems to be on the rise. And last week, of course, we breathed a sigh of relief that the new head of Interpol wasn't a crony of Putin's, from a criminal regime. That's completely Kafkaesque. Mercifully, that didn't happen. But Trump has joined ranks with the criminals by supporting MBS, who flagrantly murdered a dissident, and the whole world knows that. And Trump doesn't care. That's what I fear, is that you have a very fragile kind of global regime of democracy and rule of law that's under constant threat. And to my mind, the person who's undermining it the most is Donald Trump and empowering the very people who want to basically run a criminal kind of world where a handful of oligarchs have free reign.
You're absolutely right. You know, when I worked in the White House 20 years ago, suddenly we had all these dissidents coming, former dissidents coming to the White House as the presidents of their countries, former political prisoners like Nelson Mandela in South Africa, Václav Havel in Czech Republic, and Kim Dae-jung in South Korea. And honestly, it was possible to believe at that moment that we would never go back to a world where we would move towards fewer freedoms and less human rights. But it's happened, and as you say, the thing that we really didn't think would happen would be that it would be led by a president of the United States. And I did feel then and now, there's no inevitability about our democracy and our freedoms. There are always things we have to fight for. And the one encouraging thing that we've seen in the last 2 years is our institutions do seem strong. And we do have a free press that fights back. We do have independent judges who fight back. And we've seen a good number of Republicans stand up to Trump, not the electeds. Few of them have any courage at all. but others in the Republican establishment who, you know, otherwise are getting what they want. You know, certainly plenty of Republicans, from Mitch McConnell to the Koch brothers to Sheldon Adelson, like Trump because he's giving them the things they want: tax cuts, deregulation, special favors for special interests, and of course support for Israel for some of them is a pet issue. But I do think there's a lot of strong support for people of all backgrounds to say that this is not the America that we signed up for and that we were born into. But again, the combination of the rich people who are benefiting from it and the angry people, the working class racist people who get riled up by Trump, is a formidable alliance. And when you have Matt Whitaker, you know, our new acting attorney general, was getting paid, you know, was a lawyer in Iowa making $70,000 a year and running various scams, suddenly is getting paid over $1 million to work for a secret dark money conservative organization starting in 2014. God knows why, but God knows why the secret donors who gave to that to get him to attack progressive causes and progressive politicians, what do they want now that he's suddenly been made attorney general? There's always conservative money and dark forces on the right that are ready to work in concert with, you know, and rile up these angry working class racist voters, and could easily lead to a second Trump term. And then I don't know if there's any turning back for our country.
And again, I'm speaking with David Halpern, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Now, Whitaker really does raise this alarming reality about who's really pulling the strings and running things in this country. And one of the eminence gris, the most powerful, least known people, who was a champion of Whitaker's and who lobbied the White House to put Whitaker in as the chief of staff of the former Attorney General Sessions, was Leonard Leo. And Leonard Leo, yep, of the Federalist Society, is the one who brought us Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. He also was behind Roberts, Alito, Thomas, the whole bunch of them that now are the conservative majority on the Supreme Court. This one man has had an extraordinary influence. And if you look into who he is and what he thinks, it's terrifying. You know, he's a member of this bizarre ultra-right-wing Catholic organization, the Knights of Malta. He's a completely opaque figure, and yet he has this extraordinary amount of influence. So when you asked rhetorically a minute ago, David Halpern, what do they get out of putting their guy in as the Attorney General of the United States? That question really looms large.
Yeah, Leonard Leo, he's not even the head of the Federal Society. That's how sneaky he is. He's the number two guy there. He clearly is interested in getting rid of abortion and other, things, human rights things that modern-day right-wing conservatives and conservative Catholics hate. But I don't know how much he cares about the other side of it, the deregulation. But he certainly made common cause with those people, and he's the person behind the Judicial Crisis Network as well, along with some secret donors. Judicial Crisis Network, of course, were the ones who had ads constantly blazing on TV about Brett Kavanaugh, and who were associated with the big PR firm that did that crazy thing where they blamed Brett Kavanaugh's, you know, high school friend for being the one who actually attacked Dr. Christine Blasey Ford. So there is a big network, and there is common cause, again, between the social conservatives and the deregulation, self-interested, special interest, corporate conservatives. And Leonard Leo has certainly been at the center of that. And you've got President Trump basically saying, I have, you know, contracted out my judicial philosophy to Leonard Leo and the Federalist Society.
But that's going to be, in the historical context, that's going to be Trump's lasting legacy, the extent to which he's changed the judiciary. I mean,
I hope it's that and not a catastrophic nuclear war.
Well, that's
course, climate change long term will be part of his legacy,
right?
Because he's doing so much to, you know, prevent us from doing anything about it. But yeah, the judges is huge, and not just at the Supreme Court, but all across every court of appeals. And now, of course, he's saying since he doesn't like decisions from the Ninth Circuit, which still has quite a few judges who actually understand the Constitution, he said yesterday, we're going to be looking into it. We're going to be looking into the Ninth Circuit. He's always looking into something. But whether it means he's going to be looking into abolishing the Ninth Circuit or merging it with a more conservative court of appeals, I don't know.
Well, I'm sure our listeners are wondering, when you talk about the possibility of Trump being reelected, as appalling as he is and as much damage he does on a daily basis to this country, and while endangering the world and allowing criminality to spread and democracy to recede, the question arises, what's wrong with the opposition in this country? Why are they allowing this appalling wrecking crew, this idiot, to, you know, wreak havoc unimpeded? So what's the explanation there? I mean, the Democrats got rolled over Kavanaugh. That was embarrassing beyond belief how Schumer and company mishandled that, and Dianne Feinstein. Of course, she gets reelected. She's probably only going to serve for a year or two and then hand it over to the mayor of Los Angeles. And they're all, you know, there's a sort of geriatric club of Democrats that seem to really somehow feel comfortable with being serial losers.
I mean, you know, President Obama was president. The Democrats controlled Congress. I think in some ways it's remarkable the Democrats do so well, given the big money on the other side, the unlimited ability of corporations and conservatives to spend money, to dominate elections, to do the redistricting. You know, they have, and just the way that the Electoral College is, and the Senate is stacked in favor of rural states and everything else, all the structural impediments that hurt the Democrats, I think that they're actually doing okay. But yes, they haven't been the most inspired. They don't have a message. You know, what is their message? They don't have a strategy. And they're in bed often with the same special interests. You look at the Democrats who came up, you know, supported Kavanaugh, or who say they're for Hillary and cheer for Hillary and then go lobby for the oil companies and the for-profit colleges and the payday lenders and everybody else that is screwing people and then supposedly stand against what the Democrats stand for. So they're a conflicted mess in terms of they too are corrupted by money. And they faced all the impediments of big money on the conservative side. And yes, they really don't know where they're headed. I do think there are good leaders among the many Democratic politicians and people who could stand out. And I do think I see some hope in a Democratic contest that is a free-for-all rather than, last time, a coronation.
Well, who would you name? I mean, there are a couple of people on who are not among. I mean, one of the things that offended me about how badly that the Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee handled Kavanaugh, Feinstein sitting on that letter, couldn't even drive from San Francisco to Palo Alto to meet this woman who turned out to be a very, very effective witness. Had that happened earlier, they would have had much, much more time to investigate. Instead of that rushed last minute. And every day the press were finding out more about this man being, you know, a drunk, a rapist, and a gambler. I mean, for God's sake. But he's now on the Supreme Court for life. So but you had, in the course of that fiasco, you had Kamala Harris and Cory Booker auditioning, for God's sake. So they're the names that come up, along with Elizabeth Warren, who certainly out of the gate, with her DNA test to prove her Native American genealogy. That was not deftly handled. Maybe there are other leaders that aren't getting the attention. I like Senator Chris Murphy. I think he's really a principled and extremely knowledgeable on foreign policy. The governor of Montana also is an interesting character. Who do you think is a possible leader of the Democratic Party?
Well, I mean, in terms of, like, I'll mention some senators, not necessarily as presidential candidates, but people that I've had a chance to work with whom I think are good leaders right now in taking on Trump. That would include former Attorneys General Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island and Richard Blumenthal from Connecticut. It would include Senator Warren, Senator Durbin, Senator Harris. these are people who can forcefully stand up to the president. I would say in the House, Elijah Cummings, Maxine Waters, Raul Grijalva. There are people who are good legislators and good advocates from those positions. I think almost none of those are presidential candidates. I agree, Chris Murphy. I like Sherrod Brown, senator from Ohio, as a possible candidate. I like Senator Harris. Some people don't. I like her. I mean, you know, Jay Inslee is governor of Washington, is a good advocate, a good leader. There are across the country, I think, good people. And in my view, we'll have a contest. There'll be 40 people. Maybe it'll get down to 15 people on the stage. And I think that whoever captures the imagination of the Democratic voters might well end up being the person who's the strongest to take on Trump. And, you know, it doesn't, I honestly don't think it has so much to do with where they stand on the spectrum from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to Joe Manchin. I really do think it's more about, do they project a vision, a confidence, a sense of going for the jugular, of fighting for working people. And I mean, it may just sound kind of Pollyannish, but I do think that someone will emerge. Sitting around, you know, in our salons trying to figure out who is the perfect candidate, there is no perfect candidate from this field. Joe Biden appeals to older people in Pennsylvania, sure, but he's, you know, in his 70s, and other people have a beef with him of some kind. People think Senator Booker is, yeah, he's showboating. But I think someone good will emerge from this field, and that will be the right person to take on Trump. And then hopefully we will close ranks. There won't be the Hillary-Bernie, you know, grudge at the end of it. And everyone from the millennials to people of color to white working people to the elites will say, this is an urgent thing. We've got to get out and get rid of Trump. And then, of course, the next hurdle, which I've mentioned to you, is I'm concerned that if Trump loses, he won't leave. And for that's why we need General Mattis to stick around.
Well, David Hubbard, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Halpin, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking to the extent to which Trump's unconditional embrace of the murderous Saudi Crown Prince MBS will curtail or undermine efforts by Secretary of Defense Mattis and Secretary of State Pompeo to bring an end to the disastrous war in Yemen. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Dr. Sheila Carapico, who is a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond. Recently, she was a visiting professor in the political science department at the American University of Cairo, and is the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia. And her latest book is Political Aid and Arab Activism, Democracy Promotion, Justice and Representation. And she's a contributing editor to Middle East Report. And her latest book is Arabia Incognita, Dispatches from Yemen and the Gulf. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Sheila Carapico.
Good to be with you.
Well, thank you. And now that the Thanksgiving holidays are over, and there's, I think, going to be a pretty intense political period now up until Christmas. Rumors are that by the end of the week there might be some indictments coming down from Robert Mueller. But we do have a president who seems to be under siege, but it's so extraordinary that he's thrown his lot in with Mohammed bin Salman in the face of a global absolute abhorrence at the kind of medieval butchery that is clearly can be laid at the hands of Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince. And yet the president, you know, last week was tweeting out thanks to Saudi Arabia for low oil prices. But since you're a specialist on Yemen, I think the greatest tragedy here, surely, is that efforts on the part of Secretary of Defense Mattis and Secretary of State Pompeo to end the Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen are likely to be stalled or undercut now that Trump has given unconditional report to the architect of this war, Mohammed bin Salman.
Indeed. I mean, one has to be a little bit cautious, I think, about how serious the members of the administration are. So initially Pompeo called first for the Houthi rebels, so-called, to stop firing missiles. And then subsequently was the word the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia would cease fire. Since then there's been, you know, at least some indications on both sides that they intend to stop. But at the same time as Pompeo was calling for again, a ceasefire starting with the opposing side, there was actually an escalation. Now we see a pause, perhaps, or at least last week we saw some kind of pause, but it's all a bit murky and mysterious, frankly.
Well, as far as I know, the U.S. has stopped refueling Saudi Arabian warplanes that are bombing indiscriminately in Yemen, killing more recently a busload full of school kids.
Yes, but we also heard reports that the Saudis have acquired a better capability of doing their own refueling.
And is that a part of the Trump keeps talking about the $110 billion of arms they're buying from the United States, which are jobs, he keeps referring to. But as far as I know, according to the Pentagon, there's only been $14 billion so far ordered. Would that include in-flight refueling?
It's quite possible. I must say that I'm not very familiar with the exact technology that's necessary for this, or indeed what is inside that $14 billion that has recently been announced. But I'm just saying that we've also seen reports that recently the Saudis have acquired a better capability to do their own refueling. And even if the U.S. stopped exporting weapons tomorrow, I mean, it's not as if they're short of weapons.
Well, they're awash with weapons. Nobody knows.
Yes, exactly. They're awash with weapons.
Right. We don't know what their military capabilities are. Certainly, from what we've seen in Yemen, their air force has been completely indiscriminate. But it's almost as though they've really gone after, in a kind of medieval way, to destroy this country. You've got half the population starving. The latest report from the UN, I think, has like 85,000 children have died from starvation. There's half a million suffering from starvation. They bomb water treatment plants. They bomb facilities treating the cholera outbreak, which is a result of destroying the infrastructure. They've gone after antiquity sites. They blew up a museum that has one of the few fragments of the original Quran. It's just bizarre what's going on. How do you see it? I mean,
you've kind of summarized how I see it. I referred to it as de-development. In addition to the things you named, they've also very clearly and deliberately, a colleague of mine has documented, have targeted agriculture and fishing boats. So, in other words, you know, twofold or threefold, you know, preventing imports. Targeting other sources of food, domestic sources of food, and then, as you mentioned, also targeting water facility and sewage facility. So, I mean, it is a deliberate policy of starvation, disease, and economic destruction for no, you know, obvious or discernible objective other than to inflict suffering.
So the boy king, MBS, obviously has complete impunity and unbelievably reckless. The CIA report that Trump has ignored that finds MBS responsible for the murder of the Washington Post journalist Khashoggi. Basically, they said in this report that MBS goes from 0 to 60 in a second. So we're throwing our lot in with this guy, which I think is extraordinary. And Trump's last week was saying, well, basically, you know, we've got to stand by Saudi Arabia. You're not standing by Saudi Arabia. You're standing by this psychotic little thug who spends $1 billion on a chateau and a yacht and $500 million on a fake Da Vinci while he's causing the starvation of 500,000 children. I mean, where's the moral outrage?
You know, I mean, that's a very good question. And you mentioned briefly, Khashoggi, and it's worth noting that the last op-ed or column that he published before his death in the Washington Post, not the last one written, but the last one published before his assassination, was a criticism of the war in Yemen. And the title is Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Must Restore Dignity to His Country by Ending Yemen's Cruel War. Unfortunately, I mean, Khashoggi, in a certain sense, is a martyr to the Yemen war, but his death has, you know, sadly, but also in a way happily, called attention to the disaster in Yemen, so that at the very least, people are starting to notice. I'm getting, you know, emails from high school students who are studying it in their social science classes and so forth, so we at least are starting to see some outrage, whereas before, you know, a month or two ago, it was basically ignorance. But I don't know, Americans, I think it's very difficult for them to imagine Yemen as a place with real people. So you see much more outrage over women not being able to drive in Saudi Arabia, despite the fact that many of them have, you know, chauffeurs. So it's not as if they're suffering, you know, on the same scale. So, but we're at least now seeing some outrage, and I guess that's what's going to have to pass for good news.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sheila Karapiko, who's a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond. She was recently a visiting professor in the political science department at the American University of Cairo and is the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia. And she's a contributing editor to Middle East Report, and her latest book is Arabia Incognita, Dispatches from Yemen and the Gulf. So what do you expect? Do you think anything's going to happen in the next couple of weeks before the government shuts down for Christmas? I know Chris Murphy in the Senate has been a real champion to try and bring this forward, and it seems like the butchery of Khashoggi has really brought Yemen to the fore, even though, of course, there's a tremendous deficit in coverage in the news media. There's not a lot of news reporters down there and television reporters. So when the UN calls it the worst humanitarian disaster on the planet, that doesn't seem to resonate. But I have a feeling that the murder of Khashoggi has changed the calculus a little bit.
Well, I think it has. Certainly Chris Murphy has been at this for a while. I mean, for at least the entire of this year, if not before. I mean, one possibility, frankly, because the Saudis, I mean, it's quite remarkable that between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and the other, you know, kind of client states that are helping to provide some of the foot soldiers, that they haven't been able to make any progress against a not, you know, very sophisticated military operation, which is entirely on the ground and mostly handheld or shoulder-launched weapons, small weapons, no air power, no sea power. It's amazing that this well-armed coalition hasn't made any progress. One possible theory, frankly, is that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the Emirates both are at this point might be almost grateful for a way out so that they could restore, as Khashoggi said, some of their dignity. Not by declaring victory, but by accepting a ceasefire and saying, look how generous we are. Look how we're accepting American and international pressure. I mean, because, of course, Germany and some other countries are really, presenting more pressure. But it really is conceivable at this point, given the unlikelihood of an actual military victory, that they're willing, maybe even eager, to be persuaded to stop. Whether that will actually stop all the fighting on the ground, it remains to be seen.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, President Trump, in excusing MBS for the outrageous murder of the Washington Post journalist, he basically says, we're united against Iran. Iran is the enemy. And he kept saying, well, Iran does worse stuff. China does worse stuff. Everybody else does all this terrible stuff. So therefore, killing a journalist is not a big deal.
Well, Iran hasn't attacked any place. I mean, it might support Hezbollah, but it itself hasn't attacked anywhere. So the notion that, somehow Iran is the villain is, it's difficult to know whether the president is actually delusional or, sort of deliberately making things up. I mean, that's a judgment call I'm not prepared to make. But, the Saudi argument that the reason why they're murdering Yemenis, in huge numbers is because somehow the people that they're firing at have a relationship with Iran. It's preposterous. We've yet to see a photograph of an Iranian. There was one photograph of an Iranian weapon that was actually photographed inside of Saudi Arabia where they bought it, not even on the ground. So the evidence of Iranian collusion is tenuous. I mean, I'm not saying there's none. But as an excuse for this level of warfare and sadism and starving children, it's just unbelievable.
Well, Dr. Sheila Karapika, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're more than welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sheila Karapika, who's a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond. Recently, she was a visiting professor of political science department at the American University of Cairo and is the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia. She's a contributing editor to Middle East Report, and her latest book is Arabia Incognita, Dispatches from Yemen and the Gulf. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the lead author of a new study, Costs of War.
Come, you masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind disks.
This is a war we can win. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins? And I don't know.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Netta Crawford, who's a professor of political science at Boston University and the author of Accountability for Killing, Moral Responsibilities for Collateral Damage in America's Post-9/11 Wars. She has served on the governing boards of the Academic Council of the United Nations System and on the governing council of the American Political Science Association. And she's the lead author of the new report at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University, Costs of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Netta Crawford.
Thank you for having me.
And the report that you've done is extraordinary in as much as, I don't know whether whatever happened to the guns and butter argument, but it seems to have sort of over the decades sort of gone away. And there's just an assumption that we have to spend a lot of money of our treasure on the military, and more, it seems, and President Trump campaigned on the idea that our military had been depleted. He, in fact, recently said that the reason that he really is angry at President Obama is because he depleted our military so much. He said that in response to the former First Lady basically saying that they were appalled at the birther conspiracy that Trump had launched and how that had really impacted their own personal security. And in defense of that, Trump said, well, he was angry at Obama for not spending enough on our military. So this report of yours should really be a wake-up call, isn't it? I mean, if our listeners could think for a second about what $6 trillion could have done for making life better for Americans, because there's no way in the world you can argue that that $6 trillion that was wasted in the Middle East did any good for anybody, but just left a massive pile of corpses and rubble.
Well, it's not all spent in the Middle East, by the way, but if you think about it, there's several categories of spending here. Some of it has been spent, about $1 trillion each, in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And some of it's been spent on Homeland Security, but the question is, has the money spent on Homeland Security provided us with any more security than we would have had otherwise? And there's also a lot of this $6 trillion, which is actually going to take care of the veterans of these wars. So we've already spent quite a bit to pay for their health care, but we will be paying for their health care for the next 30 and 40 years.
So the body count you have in your report, $6 trillion spent on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and Homeland Security and in Pakistan, and the 500,000 deaths, they don't include the 500,000 that have died in Syria. But you also say that the death toll may be much higher, and it could be compounded by hundreds of thousands killed by the side effects of these conflicts. So elaborate on that, if you will.
Sure. We are also not counting in this report deaths in Yemen, which the United States proxy is waging. That is, Saudi Arabians are fighting basically for the U.S. in Yemen. But there are two kinds of deaths that we try to keep track of. One is the direct death that's caused by bombs, bullets, fire. That's called direct death because it's a direct effect of conflict and fighting. But there's also indirect death, and that's what you've alluded to earlier. It's the kind of mortality that occurs because of a loss or destruction of infrastructure. So let's say a bomb takes out the electricity grid, as our bombs did in Iraq in 2003. Well, if you don't get that electricity grid up and running, then people don't have access to safe drinking water or refrigeration. Hospitals can't function as effectively and so on. So there are ripple effects of the destruction of infrastructure, the same when you destroy water or hospitals themselves. When you have a war and you leave societies in rubble, that means that, you know, a year, two, 3 years from now, people will be still feeling those effects, even if the fighting has moved away from them.
Well, sadly, we have to add that the war still continues. The longest war in American history is the war in Afghanistan, and it's now in its 17th year with no end in sight. I suppose in defense of Donald Trump, there haven't been too many deaths on his watch, have there?
Well, the United States is fighting from the air right now, for the most part, in Iraq, and has a few advisors there on the ground. In Afghanistan, as we know, just last week and a half ago, there was another death of a U.S. soldier. But there are fewer deaths of U.S. soldiers and fewer injuries in Afghanistan and Pakistan because much of the direct fighting has been put onto Afghan forces. But what that means is that Afghan forces are dying at high rates, and in fact, we don't even know how many of them are dying because the Pentagon has classified those numbers, even though they used to make them public. And it also means that Afghan civilians are subject to forces that aren't as well trained in avoiding civilian casualties as the U.S. forces are. So in some instances, for instance, with airstrikes, civilian casualties have increased in Afghanistan as the Afghan military forces have taken over the fighting.
And again, I'm speaking with Etta Crawford, who is Professor of Political Science at Boston University and the author of Accountability for Killing, Moral Responsibility for Collateral Damage in America's Post-9/11 Wars. She has served on the governing board of the Academic Council of the United Nations System and on the Governing Council of the American Political Science Association. And she's the lead author of the new report at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Boston University, Costs of Wars. And the report used data spanning from October 2001 to October of 2018. And in terms of the direct cost of human cost for the U.S., throughout these wars in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq, the U.S. has lost 6,951 troops, 21 civilians, and 7,820 contractors. So that leads to questions about the extent to which, and this goes back to the Iraq War, the American public don't really have skin in the game as they did, for example, in the Vietnam War, given that back then there was the draft and young Americans were very concerned about going to war and dying in a war that they didn't believe in or couldn't understand what the objectives were. And certainly the government at no point was able to explain the objectives in a very coherent way, which I guess you could make that case in the so-called war on terror too. War on terror being a war against a concept, terror, which in itself is a little fuzzy. So how much is that a factor in a sense that we're paying enormously for these wars? Other people are suffering along with our own soldiers, but not in the numbers that were lost in Korea and in Vietnam. But the fact that the only people who are bearing the burden, shall we say, are the military families themselves. But the rest of America is not that affected. Is that the situation?
Yeah, very few families in America have a member in the military serving in either the reserves or in active duty forces. And that's a big change, as we know, since the late 1970s. But I want to highlight one thing that you said. You mentioned that there are about almost 7,000 soldiers and sailors killed in these wars since 9/11. And then you also mentioned that there's almost 8,000 contractors. So that's a way that some of this death, and in fact the maiming, is kind of concealed. Because what you don't see and talk about, and they don't get huge parades and military funerals, are the contractors who've been injured and killed in these war zones. And this sort of privatization of war means that, again, it's less visible to us. Another way that these wars are less visible to us is the fact that, as I mentioned before, other countries' militaries are fighting alongside with us. So the British have borne some of the costs, and so the Germans and other allies. And in addition, what you see is more than 100,000 Iraqis and Afghan military and police have died in these wars. That's what we know so far. And in Afghanistan, there's some, as I said, concealing or not revealing of the actual numbers of troops. So there's quite a bit of death. If the United States had actually just gone in alone and done this, many more U.S. servicemen and women would have been killed and injured.
Well, of course, the president doesn't seem to be aware that NATO has been an ally and Article 5 was invoked when the U.S. went into Afghanistan, and there has been a burden sharing on the part of NATO, because the president's been very critical of NATO to the point where he's never endorsed the notion of Article 5, which has made a lot of Western European leaders nervous. But in terms of my original framing, Netta Crawford, about the guns and butter argument, I mean, What happened to that argument? Because, again, if we had spent $6 trillion on making America great again, to be deliberately ironic, we'd have some real visible results, would we not?
That's true. For every $1 million that you spend on military, you get about 9,000 jobs. But if you spent that same $1 million doing something else, education, healthcare, transportation, other forms of infrastructure improvement, let's say, turning to solar and wind, you'd have many more jobs created. I think for teachers, it's about twice the number for every $1 million spent. So tens of thousands of jobs could have been created. In fact, during the little recessions the United States has had since the 9/11 attacks. So perhaps the U.S. could have provided for its own defense against terror without going to war, and it could have used that money at home or not taxed people as much. Another consequence or guns versus butter problem is that the United States did not raise taxes and sell war bonds to go to war after 9/11. Instead, what the U.S. did was go into deficit spending, because the U.S. essentially was at a surplus on 9/11. And then nearly immediately, the U.S. began deficit spending. Now, you can't do everything everywhere all the time. You have to make choices. But the U.S. didn't make choices. It chose, in fact, to do everything everywhere all the time and then increase its debt. It's like putting the wars on a credit card.
Well, you argue in your report that in sum, the high costs of war and war-related spending poses a national security concern because they're unsustainable. The public would be better served by increased transparency and by the development of a comprehensive strategy to end the wars and deal with other urgent national security priorities. So elaborate on that, if you will.
Sure. Let's just take one priority. Since the 1980s and 1990s, the Pentagon, at least, has acknowledged that global warming is a looming problem. And in fact, we know that we're already seeing the consequences of global warming. Now, the Pentagon had two things on its mind when they started looking at this problem. How will their forces operate with higher sea levels and higher temperatures? And then what kind of conflicts would come because of global warming? Would there be increased migration and refugees, which we've seen in Syria, and actually climate change may be a cause of the war in Syria, an important one? And would we see other national security risks heightened? So instead of dealing with climate change by reducing our greenhouse gases, what the United States did was go to war, which it took the world's largest fuel user, that is 105 billion barrels of oil on average a year between 2010 and 2015. It took the U.S. to war and increased greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere. So that's a consequence. But if we weren't at war, we would not be producing as much greenhouse gases. But now we see that the greenhouse gas concentrations are rising and we're less secure. So arguably, our actions have either not made us secure or they've made us less secure. And, it's unclear to me that it wasn't the case that defending our ports more efficiently, hardening aircraft as was done, increasing security checks, those are the factors that made the United States safer, not taking the war on terror abroad.
Well, you have to add to that the irony that the first Gulf War was about allegedly protecting the U.S.'s access and the world's access to Middle East oil. And it even prompted the then President George W. Bush to say we're addicted to oil. So
he said it was about jobs.
Right, right. Well, of course, but the arguments...
Essentially, great for oil.
Right, but the arguments that we're hearing from the president about defending the Saudis to this moment, is particularly about the murder of the Jamal Khashoggi, is that the Saudis give us jobs. So jobs has become the excuse. But I find it pretty extraordinary that, and I know it's not entirely related to your study, but that here we have a president who boasts about spending even more on the Pentagon, and they're $716 billion now. We're spending more on defense than we spent at the height of the Cold War when we had real enemies, a real enemy, the Soviet Union, that could have wiped us off the map in half an hour. And yet we've got these sort of obscure terrorist groups, the latest of which, or the last of which, Al-Qaeda and ISIS, is being rounded up and destroyed as we speak. So it's hard to understand. But at the same time, Trump is throwing money at the Pentagon. He started out his campaign insulting John McCain, an American war hero. And more recently, he's insulted the SEAL admiral who led the raid on bin Laden, prompting a lot of senior military officers to question our president's leadership capabilities. So what do you make of that paradox? I mean, what is it Trump is trying to do here if he's insulting military leaders at the same time throwing money at the Pentagon? Is that basically his simplistic idea that money equals power?
Well, perhaps that's the case. But I actually don't spend a lot of my attention looking at what Mr. Trump says. And what I'm looking at, or what you've just pointed at, which is the way that the military budget has increased at essentially a time when it doesn't have to increase, and in fact it should decrease, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. And the other thing is looking at the sort of patterns of investment. So this year, this fiscal year, the spending will be over $700 billion. And we're on track to keep spending that much and more. Right, and then baked into the plans of the Pentagon are plans for acquisition of more weapons and the continuing war on terror, that is, continuing to fight in Afghanistan, Iraq, if necessary, Syria, and about 80 to 90 other countries where U.S. special forces are operating, some of it, in fact, much of it clandestinely. So, yes, the United States made a turn after 9/11 out of fear that there would be another attack. It made a turn to investing in the military and using military force on the theory that the best defense is a good offense. Well, it's not necessarily the case. And in fact, there's good research by economists and others that show that when you inadvertently kill a civilian in your attempts to kill a militant, what you do is you increase militancy. And that's why you see, yes, thousands of Al-Qaeda and ISIS and other militants, Taliban, have been killed, but they don't go away. They don't go away, even though our estimates of how many there were are well exceeded by the number who just keep coming back. It's like whack-a-mole out there. They don't go away because we're actually making people dislike the United States because people don't see an end to these wars. If we turned away from war, I think militancy in these areas would decline gradually because people are sick of it.
Well, Netta Crawford, I thank you very much. We should have a revisit this conversation because it's a lot more to talk about, but I'm very grateful to you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Netta Crawford, who's professor of political science at Boston University and the author of Accountability for Killing, Moral Responsibility for Collateral Damage in America's Post-9/11 Wars. She has served on the governing boards of the Academic Council of the United Nations System and on the governing council of the American Political Science Association, and she's the lead author of a new report at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University, Costs of War. And we'll include a link to the Costs of War study at backgroundbriefing.org. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.